welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, April 6th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. On the very top of the front page, we have a picture of a home in full blaze, and the story is official. Residence total loss after fire. A Dubuque residence is considered a total loss following a massive blaze on Monday evening, though no injuries were reported. Firefighters responded at about 5:30 p.m. to a structure fire at 590 Clark Drive, said Dubuque Assistant Fire Chief Cal Motch. The building was heavily involved when they arrived. Shortly after 6 p.m., the structure was fully engulfed in flames with black smoke billowing into the sky. Portions of the charred building started to collapse as firefighters sprayed down the structure. We had heavy fire and smoke, so it was a defensive approach from the beginning, Motch said. Firefighters worked to keep the blaze from spreading to nearby structures and dealt with a gas line that burned off at the meter. A crew from Black Hills Energy arrived on scene to shut off the gas. They had to dig the line up in the street and pinch it off, Motch said. The structure was not occupied at the time of the fire, and the residents of the building had been accounted for, Motch said. He said he was not aware of any injuries. The Clark Drive building is considered a total loss, he said. The blaze also melted the siding on nearby houses. Motch said officials do not yet know the cause of the fire, and that the assistant fire marshal had interviewed the residents. The property at 590 Clark Drive has a long history of city code violations. A 2008 medical call to the home prompted local authorities to call the structure uninhabitable. To summarize, this was one of the most unsafe houses that I have ever worked in, then Assistant Fire Marshal Mike McMahon wrote in a report at the time. Paramedics entering the home in 2008 found a dimly lit jumble of loose, live wires, uneven staircases without a railing, and garbage strewn throughout the house. The house at 590 Clark Drive, owned by Kevin Gladwin, now 60, was later found to have multiple code violations after city electrical, plumbing, building, and fire inspectors searched the home. One violation involved an open electrical panel exposing residents to 220 volts of electricity, which could easily cause instant death to anyone coming in contact with the interior components, a city building code inspector wrote in a report. Gladwin is still listed as the owner of the building in online property records. The City of Dubuque filed a notice of code violations against Gladwin, 590 Clark Drive, last month for garbage considered to be a public nuisance. City officials asked that he be fined $750 and ordered to remove the garbage and maintain the property in a safe and sanitary condition, according to online court records. Contact information for Gladwin could not be located Monday evening. Robin Chaffee, who lives across the street from 590 Clark Drive, said she was getting ready to leave the house when they walked out the front door and saw the nearby residence ablaze. The whole deck was on fire, she said. She watched the fire unfold outside a nearby residence. We basically came over here because the cops were telling us we needed to get out from under the electrical wires because it was just raging, she said. The blaze melted the siding off one side of her house. Trista David, who lives on Merchants Lane near the scene of the fire, said she was getting ready to take her daughter to softball practice when she saw the smoke out the window. She came outside to see the top of the structure fully engulfed in flames. We walked outside and you could just feel the heat, she said. Firefighters were still on the scene as of about 7:30 p.m. The article is accompanied, of course, by a quite dramatic picture of flames leaping high from a house that looks almost totally engulfed in flames. The address of that house, again, as mentioned several times in the article, is 590 Clark Drive. And just below that first story, in the middle of the front page, a BizBuzz story reported by Jeff Montgomery, book marks 150 years for Dubuque manufacturer. A new book chronicles the history of a local manufacturer that recently celebrated a milestone anniversary. Clower Manufacturing, a family enterprise's first 150 years. examines how the business grew from a small hardware company into a successful fifth-generation manufacturer that makes siding, roof flashings, and more. William Clower, who serves as chairman of the board for Clower Manufacturing, said that the company will not be selling the book. However, copies are available beginning Wednesday, April 7, at the Dubuque Museum of Art, which is accepting donations for the book. "We were not in it to make money," he said. "We are absorbing the costs and have been passing copies of the book out." Brian Cooper, retired Telegraph Herald executive editor, authored the book and learned that the company and the family running it are intertwined and inseparable. He also learned that the company has made a significant local impact, including providing countless jobs over the course of the past century and a half. "Even during the Great Depression, they preserved jobs. They strived to keep people busy and keep people employed as much as they could," Cooper said of his research. Clower said he hopes the book will serve as an interesting read for customers, current employees, and retirees alike. "I have a lot of pride that we have been around this long and we have treated people well over the years," he said. "If you ask around town, I believe we're a company that is well-liked and has a good reputation." Cooper, meanwhile, hopes the books find their way into the hands of some new, budding entrepreneurs. "I think people who are getting their feet under them in the business world could get some important takeaways from how Clower Manufacturing operated," Cooper said. "They operated ethically and honestly over the years, and it served them well." Clower Manufacturing operates two facilities in Dubuque at 1185 Roosevelt Street Extension and 2600 Washington Street. The article is accompanied by two pictures. The first is of the front cover of the book with a big circled red K in the very middle, and it shows pictures of the various aspects of the 150-year history. Clower Manufacturing is the main title, and it shows on the front a picture, a picture of the front of what looks like what have been the original store at 1236, and it says on the front, "Stoves, P. Clower Hardware," and it looks like they have several of their employees and several little children, maybe it's the family members, standing in front of a store with a striped awning. It's a very vintage-looking picture of the original Clower Manufacturing Company. And a second part of that article, Biz Buzz section, authored by Jeff Montgomery, "New Beauty Business. A Dubuque resident with extensive experience in cosmetology has opened her own business. Abby Gilpin this week launched Blush Beauty Company, located at 5025 Wolf Road in Dubuque. The business is a permanent makeup studio that also offers skin care services. Gilpin said the new enterprise is located just a couple doors down from her longtime employer, Embrace Salon. She credited the owner of that business, Tia Dalsing, for passing along the knowledge that allowed her to open her own business. "She taught me a lot and has been very supportive as I made the decision to open my own business," Gilpin said. Gilpin graduated in 2014 from Capri College in Dubuque, where she earned a license in cosmetology and aesthetics. She later earned a certification in microblading, a practice that creates a semi-permanent tattoo to mimic the natural look of eyebrows. The service is popular among a wide range of clients, including cancer patients who have been unable to regrow eyebrows. When a storefront near Embrace Salon recently reopened, Gilpin jumped at the chance to start her own business. "I felt this pull as if something was telling me, just go for it," said Gilpin. "So I did." Blush Beauty Company is open from 9 to 8 a.m. On Tuesday through Thursday, and 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Fridays. It can be reached at 563-590-1676. A Maquoketa manufacturer has completed a capital improvement project that allows it to meet the evolving needs of customers. Dynamic Tube recently launched an industrial clean line an inspection facility within its facility at 1286 East Maple Street, according to Business Development Director Brian Daines. Dynamic Tube manufactures and fabricates high-performance tubing and pipe parts used in engine, fluid, and hydraulic systems by original equipment manufacturers in the agriculture, construction, mining, railroad, and defense industries. Producing clean parts for these clients is essential. Daines explained that even minuscule particles of dirt and grime have the potential to damage the internal workings of an engine or a piece of machinery. By investing in ways to create cleaner parts, officials at Dynamic Tube believe they can meet the needs of existing clients and position the company to land new ones. The standards for cleanliness are getting more stringent as time goes on, he said. This is a response to what our original equipment manufacturer customers are telling us. Parts now go through three basic steps at Dynamic Tube. First, they are sent through a five-tank, clean-line system, Dane said. Along the way, parts will get progressively cleaner as they are dipped and flushed in these tanks. Next, the parts are sent to an inspection room and examined under a newly acquired industrial inspection microscope. It's not enough just to clean them, Dane said. You have to inspect them and make sure they are clean. Finally, the parts are capped and sealed inside the inspection room, which features an air filtration system that prevents dust from being reintroduced to freshly cleaned parts. Dane said the company invested about $250,000 on the project overall. He views it as a worthwhile expenditure. Overall, the industry is trending this direction, he said. For a company our size, I think we are ahead of the curve. Dynamic Tube has been in operation since 1976. It now employs about 65 workers. The business can be reached at 563-652-5165. There is a picture of two of the people mentioned, Brian Cooper and Amy Gilpin. And the third story on the front page found at the bottom is reported by John Cruz. City moves forward with demo request. Dubuque City Council has tentatively approved a request by the Dubuque Dream Center to allow for a historic building to be demolished, while expressing hope that the building's destruction can be avoided. City Council members approved the first reading of an ordinance amendment, which was requested by the center, to remove the building located at 1620 and 1628 White Street from the Washington Street Neighborhood Conservation District. This would allow the center, located at the corner of East 16th and White Streets, to purchase the property and demolish it to allow for the creation of green space and an external elevator addition. The proposed ordinance will not be given final approval until it is voted on again by the City Council two more times on April 19 and May 3rd. The Dubuque Dream Center provides child care services. Possessing the proposed green space would allow the Dream Center to become a licensed child care center with the state, allowing it to bring in additional revenue. City documents also state the Dream Center needs to spend grant funds by July to make the facility improvements. City staff previously discussed with Dream Center officials a proposal to close a portion of 16th Street and convert it into a play area. However, the administrative steps required to close the off-street would not allow the center to proceed with the project before its grant funds expire. As an alternative, Dream Center staff suggested using the property at 1620 and 1628 White Street to create the necessary green space and an external elevator. Dream Center officials intend to eventually build a gymnasium north of the current facility at some point, but they do not currently have the funding for the project, and a construction time frame has not yet been established. Prior to Monday's meeting, the Dubuque Historic Preservation Commission denied a demolition permit requested by Nottingham Nottingham Properties, the owner of the two mentioned properties at 1620 and 1620 White Street. Tim Conlon, owner of Conlon Construction Company and chairman of the Dream Center Board of Directors, has estimated the building would require $600,000 in demolition and rebuilding costs, documents state. Speaking during the meeting, members of historic preservation groups and the Historic Preservation Commission spoke out against the proposal, arguing that an alternative option could be developed that would allow the Dream Center to create its green space without destroying the building at 1628 White Street. We offered to work with them, the Dream Center, to examine whether they could be economically viable rehabs, but then also there is the possibility they can't be rehabbed and that they could be torn down, said Dwayne Haggerty, CEO of Dubuque Heritage Works. Robert Kimball, executive director of the Dream Center, said the center was recommended by the city staff to move forward with requesting the city council remove the 1620 and 1628 White Street property from the conservation district, and that his organization would have been willing to work with historic preservation officials if it had been properly informed that was a necessary step to take. If they would have let us know and recommended that we come up with other solutions rather than the solutions that we have moved forward with, we would have been very interested at that time to talk about solutions, Kimball said. City Council members voted to approve the three readings of the ordinance amendment out of hope that an alternative solution will be reached by then between the Dream Center and historic preservation officials. I think I want to give them a chance to work together, said City Council member David Resnick. I think they are determined to work together to make sure this is right for everybody. However, several City Council members also stated if an alternative solution is unable to be reached, they will ultimately side with the Dream Center's proposal. To me, that is a much higher and noble cause than preserving these structures, said City Council member Rick Jones. We're not tearing it down to build a residence. We're tearing it down to build a future for children. City Council member Susan Farber, who ultimately voted in favor of the ordinance amendment, initially stated she opposed it, arguing that the council should not overrule the ruling of the Dubuque Historic Preservation Commission. My major concern is why did we set up a commission if we are going to override their decisions, Farber asked. Kimball offered cautious support for the City Council's request that the Dream Center and historic preservation officials work to find an alternative solution. I'm most definitely open if we can work together and find some sort of solution, but we do have a timeline and deadline. I'm curious to see what alternatives will be presented that will give us a better option than demoing the north side property. And now we look at the opinion page for letter from the editor, Amy Gilligan, Telegraph Herald executive editor, writes in defense of Karens, the real ones. My sister is a real Karen. By that, I mean her name is really Karen. She just happens to be one of the many Karens getting regularly stung by the fact that her name has turned into a slang term to describe problematic white women. The origin of the Karen memes that have become ubiquitous on the internet gets traced back to the Central Park Black Birder incident, when a white woman called the police on a black bird watcher who had asked her to put her dog on a leash, which is the law. As the man films the incident on his phone, the woman says she will tell the police that an African American man is threatening her life if he doesn't put down the phone. It's all about unacceptable behavior on her part, and not too surprising that she became a ridiculed meme. Here's the thing. Her name wasn't Karen. As a matter of fact, her name was Amy. Why did Karen become the name chosen to pick on? That's the Russian roulette of the zeitgeist. Someone thought it sounded funnier. But in those videos you see of middle-class white women using their privilege as a weapon against black people, they aren't really named Karen for the most part. They're just labeled as Karens. So where does that leave the real Karens? I'll bet most of us know a Karen we love. The Karen in my life was born almost 10 years before me and had a deep impact on my formative years. When I was barely 5, Karen read the book Edgar Allan by John Neufeld to me. It was about a white family who adopted a black boy and the racism they experienced from their neighbors. It was the first time I had ever heard anyone talk about race and discrimination. Growing up in the 1970s, the kitchen radio was tuned to KDTH, and the strains of Kenny Rogers, Dolly Parton, Glenn Campbell, Willie Nelson, and Anne Murray was the soundtrack of the household. That is, until I started hanging out in the bedroom where Karen played her records on the stereo. There I grew to love Billy Preston, the Stylistics, Earth, Wind, and Fire, the Commodores, and Roberta Flack. I remember her pushing back on a family member who jokingly questioned the race of a guy she liked based on the sound of his name. The guy was black, and although the conversation was under the guise of humor, she was having none of it and said so. She said she was maybe 19 and I was 9 at the time. I don't remember what she said exactly, but I knew she was right. That I remember the most, the moment, more 4 decades later, tells me it left an impression. The latest memes are about COVID Karens who refuse to wear masks and consider the coronavirus a hoax. Last week, I sat beside my sister Karen, volunteering at a vaccine clinic. She is the consummate volunteer, willing to help with anything she cares about. The vaccine clinic was something she really felt called to do. It was her small way to help amid this pandemic. As a child, well, as an adult, too, I was always playing with words and language in my head. Caring was the word I most strongly associated with Karen, so that whenever I said her name, Karen was what appeared in my mind. She spells that C-A-R-I-N, apostrophe. Karen and Karen, the name, she says, are synonymous. I like funny memes, but I'm pretty over the Karen thing. It feels a bit harsh on women of a certain age who could have easily have been Paula, Marcia, Linda, Nancy, Debbie, or Donna. Calling out people for bad behavior is fine by me. We can find a better way to do it. And that was the letter submitted by the executive editor, Amy Gilligan. There is a picture, of course, of Amy Gilligan at the head of the letter article. There's another part of the opinion page called Other View, and it's by Art Cullen of the Storm Lake Times. Paddler set to tell miles of river tales during virtual Iowa Water Conference. There's a picture of Art Cullen. He's got a lot of a nice head of hair and a big bushy beard. Hank Kohler's end of summer release from the farm in northwest Iowa was the family's annual fishing trip to Otter Tail County, Minnesota, where the rain poured down on father and son when Hank was 9. "Henry, where do you figure this water ends up?" his father asked. "Down south," Hank guessed. "No," his father said, "this water flows north, up the Red River to Lake Winnebago and ultimately to Hudson Bay in Manitoba, draining to the Atlantic and Arctic Oceans." The boy dreamed right then of tracing the fur trader's route. Back home in Remsen, the family, with 6 kids, plied 320 acres and worked cattle, hogs, and chickens, while Hank mused of water. He went off to the University of Northern Iowa for his teaching degree, but never taught. He could make more flipping pizzas without having to grow up. He gave up his pizzeria work to follow the call of the water in 1979. Hank, then 27, his younger brother, Keith, Rick Wiebke of Ames, and Dennis Wiederman of Cedar Falls, paddled off Leaf Lake to the Leaf River, then the Red, and up to Lake Winnebago in Canada. About 1,330 miles and 70 days later, the boys ended up at Hudson Bay. It was one hell of a ride. Dennis wrote a book about it. This water flows north, of course. If you would like more details, personally, I want to hear more about how, like Ponce de Leon, they came along a font of beer during a portage somewhere amid the wilderness. A cadre of nurses even showed up. Hank returned to Iowa and pizza. He and Am built a family around their Happy Joe's franchise in Ames. The Skunk River kept flooding it out. He gave up on rebuilding again a decade ago and launched Hank Kohler's Learn to Fish. He brings families together to learn fishing, camping, and water. The teacher in him finally emerged. Yet something gnawed at him, like the pizza was half done. The water has taken me to marvelous places, like following the Corps of Discovery route along the Missouri. But I haven't given much back, he said. I need to make amends. While ice fishing on Leaf Lake in January 2020, his epiphany arrived. Holy crap, who's ever gone all the way north from this location? Then 40 years later goes all the way south. Nobody's done that. It's my chance. He told his fishing buddy, agronomist Dr. Rick Cruz of Iowa State University, about his idea and asked how he could use it to give back to the water. Cruz suggested raising funds for the Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. So everywhere he stops, he will try to drum up publicity to help the river by donating to the museum. Kohler will spin his fishing and paddling tales Thursday afternoon at the virtual Iowa Water Conference, which Cruz helps organize. Cruz also manages the Iowa Daily Erosion Project and is a leading evangelist for soil and water conservation. Kohler will be joined by Jared McGovern, the museum's conservation curator. The conference starts Tuesday with a host of expert speakers on everything water. One of the highlights of Dr. Gene Taukey, an Iowa State agronomist who shares a Nobel Prize for climate modeling. He warns of deep threats to agriculture and food production from a warming corn belt. Kohler plans to launch in early June, depending on water levels. He might hit New Orleans in time for a mid-August 70th birthday. A group of 10 to 12 will accompany him on stretches. Jim Egmond of Muscatine plans to float most of the way when not stumping for mayor. Brother Keith might join him at the start, and Wiedemann might hop in for a day or two just to get the band back together, Hank says. He hopes his wife will pick him up in the Big Easy. Between the two trips, four decades apart, Kohler will have paddled 3,500 miles. Before I hear my last barn owl at night, I have to do this, he says. The water has given so much, I have to give back. And there's a note at the end. Cullen is the editor of the Storm Lake Times in northwest Iowa, where he won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing on agriculture and the environment. There is a picture of Hank Kohler with a large fish. It looks like it's about 4 feet long as he holds it up, sitting in the back of a flatbed fishing boat on a lake. You are listening to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, April 6th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Among the obituaries, we have three very brief notices. Charles J. Henry, Long Beach, California, Memorial Mass, 10:30 a.m., Thursday, April 8th, St. Martin's Catholic Church, Cascade, Iowa, for Charles J. Henry, who died in Long Beach, California. Paul S. Smith, Cudahy, Wisconsin, Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m. today, St. Alphonsus Catholic Church, Greendale, Wisconsin. That's for Paul S. Smith of Cudahy, Wisconsin. And finally, Martin H. Werner, East Dubuque, Illinois, Mass of Christian Burial, 10:30 a.m. today, St. Mary's Church, East Dubuque, for Martin H. Werner of East Dubuque. And now, among our regular funeral notices, Michael J. Buck Powers, age 68, of Dubuque, died on April 3rd at Stonehill Care Center, surrounded by his loving family. The celebration of life will be held for Michael J. Buck Powers on Wednesday, April 7th, 4 p.m. at Steeple Square on 100 East 15th Street in Dubuque. Reverend Diane Grace officiating, family and friends of Mike may gather to visit from 2 to 4 p.m. at Steeple Square. Merlin J. Leek, Luxembourg, Iowa. He was 89 and died on Thursday, April 1st, at home. Visitation will be held from 9 a.m. to 10:45 a.m. Friday, April 9th, at Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Luxembourg. Cards and letters may be mailed to the family in care of the Kramer Funeral Home of Dyersville. They ask that you please make sure to include your first and last name for Martin Leek on the outside of the envelope. Mass of Christian Burial, 11 a.m. Friday, April 9th. Holy Trinity Catholic Church, Luxembourg, burial in the church cemetery. Military honors accorded by the VFW Post 7736 and the Iowa Honor Detail. The Reverend Noah Deem will officiate, and the Kramer Funeral Home is taking care of arrangements for Merlin J. Leek of Luxembourg. John E. Dadisman of Durango, Iowa, was 66 when he died on April 2nd. Memorial service, 3 p.m. Wednesday, Sherrill United Methodist Church, where friends may call Wednesday, 1 to 2:45 p.m. Let's see, his arrangements, memorials may be made to the John Dadisman Memorial Fund, and the arrangements are being handled by the Egelhoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory. That's for John E. Dadisman of Durango, Iowa, who died on Friday, April 2nd. Monticello, Iowa, Raymond Leroy Kleinow, it's K-L-E-I-N-O-W, Raymond Leroy Kleinow, age 90, died Thursday, April 1st, at the Monticello Nursing and Rehabilitation Center following a brief illness. Services will be held at a date to be announced, and you may visit the Getch online to share your thoughts, memories, and condolences with Ray's family, to sign the online guest book for Raymond L. Kleinow of Monticello, Iowa. Schulzburg, Wisconsin, Carl Leroy Walton, age 67, died unexpectedly on Sunday, April 4th, at Memorial Hospital of Lafayette County in Darlington, Wisconsin. A funeral service will be held Saturday, April 10th, at 11 a.m. at the Centenary United Methodist Church in Schulzburg. The Reverend Stanton Bockwolt officiating. Burial will be in Evergreen Cemetery, Schulzburg. Military graveside services will be accorded by the McCann Richards American Legion Post 105 of Schulzburg. A visitation will be held Friday, April 9, 4 to 8 p.m. at Erickson Funeral Home, Schulzburg, and on Saturday, 10 a.m. until 10:45 a.m. at the church. Online condolences may be expressed through the website ericksonfuneralhome.com. A memorial fund has been established for those who wish to offer toward that in the name of Carl L. Walton of Schulzburg, Wisconsin. Arthur E. Metz, 77, of Dubuque, died Saturday, April 3rd. Tri-State Cremation Center of East Dubuque is assisting the family. From Rickardsville, Iowa, Rose M. Wolf, 75, died Sunday, April 4th. Visitation, 3 to 8 p.m. Friday, April 9, at Rife Funeral Home, Piasta. Mass of Christian Burial will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, April 10, St. Joseph's Catholic Church, Rickardsville. Burial in the church cemetery for Rose M. Wolf, Rickardsville, Iowa. Lawrence C. Linderbaum of Guttenberg was 100, and he was formerly of Monona. He died on March 23rd. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 9th, and 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. Saturday, April 10th, at the Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Monona. Services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home, with burial to follow in the Monona Cemetery for Lawrence C. Linderbaum of Guttenberg. Kimberly Lowry, Platteville, Wisconsin, was 64 and died on Saturday, April 3rd. Heidenschild Funeral Home and Cremation Services, Cuba City, Wisconsin, assisting the family of Kimberly Lowry of Platteville, Wisconsin. Terry L. Mohs, M-O-H-S, Postville, was 63 and died Friday, April 2nd. Visitation, 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday, April 10, St. John Lutheran Church, Luana, Iowa. Services will be held at 2 p.m. Saturday at the church, the Leonard Grau Funeral Home, and cremation service, Monona, is assisting the family of Terry L. Mohs of Postville. The Reverend John L. O'Connor, 88, of Dubuque, died Sunday, April 4. The visitation will be held 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, April 9, from 9 to 10 a.m. Saturday, April 10, at Wallert Catholic High School. Mass of Christian burial, 10 a.m. Saturday at the high school. Leonard Funeral Home and Cremation and Crematory of Dubuque is assisting the family for the Reverend John L. O'Connor of Dubuque. From Maquoketa, Elaine A. Dull, 64, died Saturday, April 3rd. Services, 10:30 a.m. Friday, April 9, at Dawson Funeral Services, Maquoketa, for Elaine A. Dull of Maquoketa. Herbert A. Havertape, Hazel Green, Wisconsin, 82, died Saturday, April 3rd. There will be no public visitation. Private Mass of Christian burial will be held. The Miller Funeral Home of East Dubuque is assisting the family of Herbert A. Havertape, Hazel Green, Wisconsin. And finally, from Rockford, Illinois, Michael Bogue. I'm going to spell that B-O-G-E. Michael Bogue, 57, formerly of Dubuque, died Wednesday, November 25. Let me get close to that. The funeral mass will be held 1 p.m. Saturday, April 24. Holy Ghost Catholic Church, burial to follow, Mount Calvary Cemetery, for Michael Bogue of Rockford, Illinois. And that concludes the list of obituaries in today's issue of the Telegraph Herald. And now we turn to the sports page for a high school sports story. Prep Soccer, Dawn of a New Era, reported by Tim O'Neill. The questions had been asked for a long time. Tim Neiman wasn't sure he'd ever have a satisfactory answer. Neither did Dan Pierce. But a year after the entire spring season was wiped out by a worldwide pandemic, the answer was finally yes. Now, out of the ashes rise two completely new soccer programs, Cascade and Clayton Ridge, as a long-awaited spring season dawns in northeastern Iowa. I've been asked a lot of times over the years, why can't we do this in high school? Said Pierce, who has directed Guttenberg's youth program for the last 8 years and is also serving as the first head coach in the Clayton County High School's history. I guess we finally got to the point this past summer that I got asked so many times by so many more people, like, why don't we do this? Neiman was receiving those same questions in Cascade, where he describes the program as a grassroots effort with many voices. We finally had the number of people, and we finally had the support for it, Neiman said. Clayton Ridge opened its inaugural season with a 3-2 loss at Postville on Thursday before earning its first ever 8-0 victory at West Delaware on Monday. The Eagles' first home game, though, won't come until May 4th against Postville. Cascade makes its debut tonight at home against Tipton. Boys from the southwest corner of Dubuque County have long played soccer as part of the Summer Rec League in Dyersville. A few years ago, a handful of players joined nearby Western Dubuque High as part of a cooperative program. That number continued to grow, but it still wasn't as big as it potentially could have been. The first year it was, I think, 2 players, and then it was 3, and we've gradually saw more and more involvement to where it was 7 or 8 players playing with them, said Neiman, who, a longtime assistant and junior varsity coach with the Western Dubuque Boys and Girls programs, who also assists in the Rec League. I knew there were a few players that played in the summer, played with their friends, but they didn't drive all the way up, to Epworth. A lot of the players and a lot of the kids I knew wanted to play, but they didn't want to play for the other school. So, to try to give them an opportunity to represent their own community and play with their friends and play for their own school, we did some polling, and we saw that we finally had the numbers that we could support our own program. And so the Cougars went for it. The roster stands at 17, including three who played for Western Dubuque in 2019. I was pretty excited, said Willie Lynch, one of Cascade's three returning veterans. I did kind of worry about the numbers because I didn't know who all would want to go out. The numbers should be a good amount. It's nice to have that many on the bench just to sub in and out. Pierce has been involved with soccer in Guttenberg since the small river town first founded its youth program in 1986. Just 10 years old at the time, Pierce began playing but soon ran out of time. Guttenberg's youth program ended at 8th grade. It had been a goal to add varsity soccer to Clayton Ridge's athletic program, but it never quite came together. In the late 1990s, wrestling and soccer received another push for inclusion. The school added wrestling, but soccer was left by the wayside. Club soccer for high school-age players came to Guttenberg in 1998. The push to get soccer in the high school kind of died off, I guess, Pierce said. They didn't really try it again, or nobody really pursued it seriously again. Pierce has been running the youth program since his eldest daughter was old enough to play. He's been asked countless times why high school soccer wouldn't work at Clayton Ridge. There have been plenty of reasons why. Cascade is not a large town. Guttenberg is even smaller. Clayton Ridge, based in Guttenberg and drawing students from the surrounding communities, has just 153 students in 9th through 11th grades, making it the 223rd largest of Iowa's 365 high schools. Cascade is 188th with 175 students. According to classification figures for this year, only 8 schools with smaller enrollments than Clayton Ridge offer soccer. Scattered Good Friends, 21, Hillcrest Academy at 45, Clarinda Academy, 58, Grandview Christian, 111, Oak Land Riverside, 120, Highland Riverside, 131, Logan Magnolia, 131, and Wapello, 143. The concern was, we've got golf and track in the spring, and there's a spring musical and lots of different choir things going on. There's just so many activities in the spring, the thought was we don't have enough kids to do this, Pierce said. So nobody really pursued it. Until last summer, when the round of questions started rolling in, Pierce took a deeper look at participation numbers. What he saw surprised him. Even with this COVID year, last year, I had over 130 kids in our youth program, first grade through 12th grade, he said. That comes out to 10 to 11 kids per grade. So if you start doing the math there, there's enough people involved to do it. Then the big thing was, how do we do it with these other sports at the same time? We talked to the coaches of those programs and talked to some school administration of personnel. In order to do this right, coaches are going to have to work together. There's going to be some give and take, and we're going to have to allow kids to do multiple activities. We can't make them choose, otherwise it's going to hurt everybody. Neiman's pitch to prospective players was simple. Take this opportunity to participate in something historic. I know you guys are playing this sport in the summer. I know you're playing with your friends, so let's play it to represent our community. And if you haven't played it before, it's another game where you get to have some fun with your friends. You get to be physical, you get to challenge yourself, and you get to create some history, Neiman recalled saying. This is a one-time opportunity that your school is starting a soccer program. Whatever you do this year, you're creating history. And that's an awesome opportunity and an awesome responsibility. If you're there, you really have to show up. You really have to represent for your school. Athletic booster clubs have been vital in each program popping up. The financial investment could potentially be overwhelming. Pierce said purchasing new goals could cost in excess of $10,000, not to mention practice and game equipment plus field maintenance. "They've been super supportive in getting me everything I've asked for," Neiman said. "I'm not asking for crazy things, but getting us goals, getting us the nets, getting us balls, getting us practice jerseys, getting all that stuff lets us operate like a normal team and not just people who are messing around outside. Without the support from the school and the booster club, this season would be much harder than it is." Gutenberg's Kahn Manufacturing stepped in to fabricate new goals for the Clayton Ridge program. Both teams will be playing on their school's football fields. "There have also been angels in the community who just want to see the youth thriving. I know there's a lot of expense in getting things started for the first time, and we've just had people, without us pursuing it, step up and want to pay for things. That's pretty awesome," as Pierce said. Both coaches expect the typical growing pains that come with starting a program from scratch. "It's hard to expect a first-year program to reach the state tournament, let alone win a state title, but it sure is the aspiration of every player on the team to reach that stage. But with the step up in competition level comes changes in coaching." Pierce and Neiman both said their coaching styles have changed now that they're in charge of their own varsity programs. In Pierce's case, he coached a lot of his players in youth soccer, but that is a vastly different game than high school. Practices and games are usually limited to once a week for a month or two. There's a lot more focus on detail, too. "These are a lot harder practices than these kids are used to in the summer. I thought I was going to get some backlash from them a little bit," he said. "They're used to me coaching them, just not at this level. Surprisingly, to this point, they've been super enthusiastic and super hardworking, and really willing to learn the new things I'm trying to get them to figure out." Neiman has the benefit of familiarity, too. He also has the benefit of the three veterans helping get the team ready for its varsity debut. "It's going to be huge for us," he said. "I've already seen some of that leadership. Hey, guys, this is different from what you've seen in the past just playing for fun. We're going to ask you more of you. It's going to be more physical. You're going to have to step your game up a little bit. You can't take 10 seconds off because you're messing around. You've got to be more focused, and those players have a little more credibility, a little more respect, and they're able to ask more of their teammates. As far as measuring the level of success for the first season, that will be easy. We just make sure everyone gets involved," Cascade's Trevor Freeberger said. "Everyone gets to play, win or lose. It doesn't matter if everyone has fun. This is the first year Cascade has had a team." Both programs see this just as the starting point. Cascade, right now, is a varsity-only program, but the hope is to eventually draw enough athletes to field a junior varsity team. Clayton Ridge is playing co-ed with about 10 girls on the roster of 36. The Eagles will play both varsity and junior varsity this season with the hope to eventually add a girls program. "We're used to playing co-ed. That's what that summer program, club program is, and what they play as youth. But I know our girls right now would be a really tough team if we just had a handful more of them," Pierce said. "But everyone involved is just happy to see this season come. I'm really grateful for the people that started the Gutenberg program back in 1986, and now being a part of adding another layer to this. Yeah, I'm extremely proud of where we've come from and where we're hopefully going here," Pierce said. "I think we're at the tip of the iceberg here. I've already talked to some even younger kids in the junior high level that don't play, have never played soccer, and now because we have a high school sport, they want to play. I don't think we're leveling off here. We're still growing yet. So it's kind of neat to be part of the whole evolution of where it's come from." And there is a picture of an action of Cascade's Juan Alvarado shoots on goalie Willie Lynch during practice on Monday in Cascade, Iowa. There are also pictures of those who are mentioned, those couple of coaches. Let's see, there's a picture of Tim Neiman and of Dan Pierce. Tim Neiman is the author of the piece. Tim O'Neill is the author of the piece. And so, soccer. And we'll sum up with an arts item. Spectacle of Sound, Dubuque Symphony Orchestra to team up with Heartland Marimba Quartet for upcoming classics concert. I'll read briefly from the summary page. It says, if you go, the event is the Dubuque Symphony Orchestra Classics 3. That would be at 2 p.m. Saturday and Sunday, April 10th and 11th, 7:30 p.m., and it will also be, yes, and it will be at the Five Flags Theater, and the cost will be $18 to $87 plus fees. Tickets available 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., 2 to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. Five Flags Center for Center Box Office, as well as at the website fiveflagscenter.com. And there is a picture of four marimbas being played in front of what looks like a wonderful wall of glass and a diamond, black and white, a diamond tiled floor in the gathering area of a large auditorium entrance. And that does it for today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on this Tuesday, April 6th. I'm your reader, Wally Helms. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once weekly or twice monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.